Welcome to our Lunch and Learn. Feel free to come on up closer if you would like to at one of the tables. It's an informal group that we have for this event. It gives me great pleasure today to introduce Dr. Sanjaya Rajaram, the recipient of the 2014 World Food Prize and director of Resource Seeds International, Toluca, Mexico. He also served as director of the Biodiversity and Integrated Gene Management Program of the International Center for Agriculture Research in the Dry Areas, ICARDA, and director of CIMMET, Global Wheat Program. He is a tireless champion of eradicating hunger and malnutrition around the globe. Dr. Rajaram has the unique distinction of breeding the largest number of varieties of wheat, or for that matter, any crop in the world. Welcome to our friend and colleague. Welcome, Raj.
How this operates? Separate here or?
Yes.
Here, no?
Yeah, the page up and page down will work
okay.
As well.
All right. Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you, David. As you know that this is the 100th anniversary of Dr. Norman Borlaug. First, I wrote to Sarah that perhaps I should talk about the wheat, and I felt she was a little bit, that idea was a little bit not well received. So then I suggested the current title, something about talking about Dr. Borlaug. And really that's where I want to concentrate, even though the title says wheat production, legacy of Norman Borlaug, and wheat production, golden years of wheat production. I could talk a lot about Dr. Borlaug. As a matter of fact, a lot been written about Dr. Borlaug, but I can talk from the life experience because I was his postdoctoral fellow, working together in field in Sonora. Then later on, his colleague, he was still boss, and then I was plant leader. And later on, we became lifelong friend for many, many years. So I've known Dr. Borlaug from very close, his work ethic, his philosophy, the way he worked. Ron Phillips reminded me that I don't make any, perhaps I should make any joke here, okay. And I would not do that. Dr. Borlaug, you know that he believed in service to humanity through eliminating hunger and malnutrition. That I think basically summarizes his life mission. In early years after Nobel Peace Prize, he preached a lot about population control. He felt that if we can control the population, perhaps the hunger problem will be solved. But you know that that has not happened. We didn't stabilize in 1970 onwards population. It keep increasing. Currently, we are more than 7 billion people. I'll be talking about like that. He had tremendous leadership, and he always believed in team building. And he also believed training young people. He was the first one indeed in the world to start bringing training from all over the world to the Rockefeller Foundation program in Mexico. and start training. And that was the basically the triggering point, because it was just not the seed, but the people who went back to India, Pakistan, and various other places. So he believed that up to the end of his life. He kept reminding me. He used to call me, "Raja, don't forget about training at Summit." And we're very pleased to say that we have trained a lot of people. I'll give you some example. It's not changing. You all know Jeff Reich, in his speech, talked about this Dr. Borlaug and stem rust. His last wish before he died was that somehow we should keep working, keep reminding people that the stem rust is still very devastating. And as a matter of fact, the UG99 program, led by CEMET, Cornell University and CEMET, is in the forefront in that area. A lot of progress been made indeed, but he believed that, and it coming out of his work in 40s and 50s, when the rust destroyed the crops, wheat crops, all the way, all over the world, but perhaps the communication was not that much, but we know that all the way from Mexico, over all the way from Argentina, to United States, Canada, stem rust was predominant everywhere. Also very well known about his collaboration with Dr. Orville Bogel on the dwarfing genes. And the connection goes to Japan, of course, the origin of dwarfing genes. It's very difficult to just say Dr. Borlaug and not mention Dr. Bogel. There's a big story about what happened. The time doesn't permit me, but what triggered the wheat revolution, green revolution, is incorporation of the dwarfing gene, and there are only one and two in the high resistant, stem rust resistant wheats. Even I've read that one gene or two genes saved millions of people, life of people. And that's where the technology is. Then his work, of course all of you know that he the Green Revolution terms was not given by Dr. Borlaug. It was termed by somebody, I'm just not remembering at this time, but in 1963, prior to that, as a matter of fact, 1961, Dr. Borlaug had sent a lot of his wheat varieties to through international, USDA International Rust Nursery around the world. India, there, led by Dr. Swaminathan, was also looking at dwarfing genes through mutations program. However, the dwarfing genes were there, and that is the beginning of all the connection, and I don't go in details because it's all been told. This is young Swaminathan and Borlaug talking each other in fields in New Delhi. Swaminathan and Dr. Borlaug became not only great friends, but pursued the adoption of their high yielding varieties in India, which led to Green Revolution, which led to very high production in that country in beginning 70s. His colleague, Dr. Bajwa, was similarly instrumental in Pakistan pursuing the adoption of high yielding varieties in. And it would be, I would say that not mentioning Dr. Glenn Anderson from Canada, was Dr. Borlaug's envoy. He was his right-hand man, ambassador in India, roving between India and Pakistan, trying to see that, make sure that these varieties are well adapted. Dr. Anderson died very prematurely at the age of 56, but perhaps was very instrumental in adoption of these weeds in India. What I wanted to say, I don't want to go in details, describe you the Green Revolution, Dr. Borlaug's work. But I want to remind you, I was in Iowa 10 days ago, and on October 11, 2014, there was an article by Sharon Donovan in an Iowa newspaper alleging Dr. Norman Borlaug having destroyed thousands of small family farms in India that were the bedrock of the food production. That article by Sharon Donovan. However, I want to remind you, see that graph, in that graph, before Dr. Borlaug's wheat went in India, India produced 10 million metric tons, more or less, and had to be given another 10 million metric tons to meet the demands in the country. It was a basket case. Many of you perhaps would not remember. I don't remember either, very young. Nonetheless, that was the situation. Last, in 2013, India's production has gone 96 million metric tons. And basically, I can tell you this thing. That was done, that is almost 9.6 times more than pre-revolution base, but the area expansion were only 3 times. Currently, India plants wheat on 30 million hectares. In 65, were around 10 million hectares. But the production gone 9 times. Yes, there are certain problems associated with that, time, because time not permitting, I could address that. But remember what would have happened to produce, to feed the current population of India, which you need around 196 million metric tons, how much area would have been needed with the technology of the 60s if we had stayed on that technology. India doesn't have that kind of farmland. And if they had, they had to clear all the biodiversity, which Dr. Barbara talks in the morning about, preserving those biodiversity, which I also believe that we got to preserve that. But look at the consequences. It wasn't Indian scientists did that along this summit, all this continuing increasing, but that was the legacy drove. Borlaug's legacy drove that to continuously commitment from the government, high energetic scientists, policy makers, and the good Indian farmers. And they are all small family farmers. They're not corporate farmers. They don't have 100 hectares and 50 hectares. They have 2 to 5 hectares. And seldom you find maybe 50, few larger areas. So this was small farms before 70 where the people were dying. This is the same size of farm where now have excess food production. Their problem still remains problem in India. But the problem very much associated with the distribution of food and not the production of food. It's a policy dimension which has not allowed going food to the poor people. India cited having one of the largest number of hungry people. And this is because they don't have employment. There's social problems which need to be solved. But they have the food. Indeed, 2 years ago, Indian Supreme Court ordered Parliament unless they distribute that food, otherwise they will do something. Now I believe that both Parliament, the Supreme Court, and the judiciary and the government all very much want to modify the policies so that some way food reaches to the poor. I just wanted to, not that it matters very much that India is so and so now. I want to take that case to illustrate, to elucidate, highlight the legacy of Borlaug. Just only two cases of India, but there are perhaps other 50 countries. I can go and describe that to you. That's me with Dr. Borlaug early years. We know we look younger there at least. And in the wheat fields, Norman philosophy was and remained. He was criticized by many people that perhaps he doesn't like good science. Yes, that was not correct. But he also believed that you have, as an agricultural scientist, if you're going to solve the problem, you have to go in the field. He stressed not that he basically was stressing G by E, that a lot of things happens in the field. He used to talk about, and this is good for the young people, that you can talk to the plants. If you talk to the plants, they will listen. And they will tell you that here I am, look, I am hungry, I need fertilizer, or I need water, so and so. They will tell you. And that's what we learn. I just wanted to talk a little bit about whenever I took over, Norman appointed me in 1973 head of the wheat breeding program. And believe me, I thought that I would be fired after 3 months. He was a hard master, difficult to satisfy. And who the hell I was, a young Indian boy, taking Dr. Borlaug's wheat program. You know. However, with hard work and similar mission, making those changes, we began to make some changes in his program. Our mission had become, when I took over, our mission had become not only international, one or two countries, but global. Fusarium head blight were devastating in USA and many other countries. Septorias and other problems, aluminum toxicity, so and so. Here I'm talking with Dr. Warren E. Cranston, who was one of the greatest collaborators I had in the United States. We worked on spring, winter, both. I got appointed adjunct professor, and I served as 15 years at Oregon State University. I wish Dr. Warren was here. We look at the world environment in the terms of breeding, based on G by E, in the globalization process. We believed that we had to put the diversity from one variety to variety at the time of the Green Revolutions. By the time I was leaving Semit, we had displayed 400 to 500 varieties all over the world, different cross combinations, so and so, because we believed that unless we had the diversity in the wheat variety, we would have disaster. Because of the stem rust, septoria, mildew, whatever that may be, insects. I took the point in the morning in Barbara's presentation, what's happening in certain other crops, but not so in wheat. We are always aware of that the diversity was there. We created the international collaboration with every country, whosoever wanted to collaborate with Semit, under Semit's mandate. We used to name our variety. Borlaug believed he had started naming his variety after the American birds. his advanced lines. Some of my successful varieties were Beeries and Barb White. I wanted to bring to your attention about the Barb White. I was in Monsanto's headquarter, and they were talking to me about the Barb White, how Barb White was great, because one of the varieties which they could use for transformation program. I did not know that, but they didn't know that I had bred that variety. And so, I mean, something can happen. This very useful gene combination sometime can make difference, a lot of difference in other areas, which we don't realize very much in the beginning. Our priorities, and Dr. Borla keep coming and checking. Indeed, in 1984, we sat down in, he had visited me in Sonora. We sat down in Sobregon in a restaurant in the evening having dinner. And he said, Raj, you can't basically allow the wheat program to go back, regress, in the terms of, he had vision even at that time of the perhaps climate is changing, high temperature tolerance, drought tolerance, salinity, and all those things would become problem. We began further expanding the wheat base in CIMMYT in early 90s, not only for yield potential, which was our continuous aim, objectives, but for disease resistance, for drought, heat. That would be almost more than 25 years ago before we were talking about that. We were aware that we needed the high temperature tolerance and the drought tolerance in certain environment. We began to collaborate with ICARDA as well. But these are some of the synthetic weeds, which is basically one of the progenitor of wheat, Agilapsis corosa. Unfortunately, it's being destroyed now in the Middle Eastern country, Middle East, where that's where it originated, because the ICARDA gene bank happened to be in Aleppo, and that's where they got 37,000 collections of the wheat relatives. Very sad situation, but that's very sad to know that. That's one of the biggest reservoir of the wheat relatives. We don't know what ICARDA can do. We expanded in China. Chinese story is another one. I've worked China in and out 20 years. I don't want to say China is today's second biggest world power, economic power. They made tremendous, but we were able to increase 20-30% higher yield potential in their wheat programs. As I said, Dr. Borlaug always reminded the trainees, and as long as I had stayed until 2002, with the exception of 1994, when our budget was not very good, but we kept the training program going on. This is in-service training program. We wanted the trainees to go and master PhD and do everything, but we wanted to come to Mexico, the wheat breeder, pathologists, agronomists, and work in the field side by side. Many times there were only 20 trainees, and we positioned 28 or 30 professors from CIMMYT to teach them. It was a tremendous experiment in making. I believe I have been told that we have trained 700 young people over the years who have become great leaders in many ways in many parts of the world. But that's Borla truly believed that that's what we had to do. I'm not going to talk about UG99. Jeff Reich has talked about that other day, reminded in his, I think, in a crop, American Society of Crops, American Society of Agronomy, or one of those settings where he talked about stem rust with Dr. Borlaug always. Current program also focuses in wheat breeding. I'm not there, but led by, under CGIAR flagship, led by Wolfgang Pfeiffer, where they're looking at the zinc, iron, and vitamin A deficiency. enriching the crops. The variations are there, and as long as they are lower yielding, farmers don't grow very much. So we need to bring them a reasonable yield and make sure that they are enriched in those micronutrients. It's a huge program in wheat in for the hygiene and program. Another issue we have to address is the water use efficiency. You can see the area of the world where basically the groundwater is declining. Even in northern Mexico where I worked, when I had arrived in 1969, water table was 70 meters. You can go 70 meters and draw good quality water. By the time in 2002 I was leaving, you had to go 232 meters to draw the water. It's a terrible situation everywhere. And so we have to be aware of that. Without water, there is no agriculture. Without fertilizer, there is no agriculture. And of course, we need advanced seed. Hybrid wheat, I do believe, is the future for the world. I believe that people can be fed very well, but we got to get involved in some of the new inventions. Most of the crops are based on now hybrid maize or rice is coming up, a lot of other crops, but wheat is still difficult. So many of you know why it is, because both female and male parts are housed in the same, very tightly same place, and it's very difficult to sterilize them. But there are genetic systems, it can be done. Here the one I wanted to make Norman Borlaug, at the age of 75, he described me, I recall, he was sitting in his office in Texas A.M., from Mr. Sasakawa. He told him, Dr. Borlaug, why what you did in Asia, why it was not happening in Africa. Of course, Norman told him that, look, I'm 75 years old and I'm not interested in, you get some young people. The story goes that the next day he received the call again from Sasakawa and he said, young man, you are 75 and I'm 85. You just get started something. That was the last frontier for Dr. Borlaug. He wanted to do something for Africa. And he did very well. He put very excellent group of people to do certain things. The thing is that here I wanted to, in 2050, African country will spend an estimated $24 billion United States dollars importing 60 million metric tons of wheat. This is an astonishing figure. That is equivalent to 50% of all wheat traded today. 100 million metric tons moves around the world, and that is the 50%, 60 million Africa additional wheat would be needing at that time. So I looked at one of the articles. National Geographic put it out. The current population, 7 billion, headed for 9.6 billion by 2050. Africa's population is 900 million and perhaps will become 2 billion by then. I felt that the National Geographic has put out a special publications. How can we solve the problem? Of course, there's no growth in agricultural area, freeze the agricultural footprints, no growth. Protect the biodiversity because we use very close to 27, 28 million miles or kilometers of lands for agriculture. Grow more on the same farms we have, that means that they bring closing the yield gaps. Yield gaps are high. use resources more efficiently, conservation agriculture. Shift diets. I'm not saying that you shift from non-vegetarian to become vegetarian. If you become vegetarian, we'll solve the problem, but I know that it's not going to happen. But 55% of the everything we produce goes for the human direct diet. The rest goes as a animal feed and the biofuels. Okay. Some animals are more efficient in producing, others not, so a lot can be done. And the reduced waste, it was mentioned in this conference many times, reduced waste. Everything we produce, as a matter of fact, I read in that article that 50% is destroyed. In the developed world, after it is harvested, in the supermarket, in the house, in the restaurants. In the developing world, just before it comes to market. This is a reality. Look at the waste in developing countries. It's tremendous. Also, if we're going to make the change, we have to find the formula how to work public-private partnership. I don't think everybody is suspicious of public and private, they're suspicious of each other. The trust, not strong trust there. I think we find a formula how to do that. Because the world will benefit if we find the formula how to work with it. So, the legacy. Let me say that I predict something. If Dr. Borlaug was alive today, of course he would be pounding everywhere, and perhaps he would be asking the world community to create a global fund to help small farmers in Africa and elsewhere. Global fund under the United Nations. He would be asking that, in my opinion. He would be continuing asking in Western infrastructure, especially roads and the market outlets for the small farmers. Remember, this is a year of the family farms. There are 500 million farms, small farms, supporting 2 billion people. Just a small change. Just the access to roads. And the facility to market their extra production will help them a lot. And I do believe that Africa will have to take responsibility. This is not, you just can't pass the buck to somebody else, the World Bank or any other organization. They can all help, but African country will have to take responsibility for themselves. Of course, use new seed technology to small farms. I'm a firm believer, and perhaps I will disagree with a lot of people, that there is no two technologies, one for the corporate and big farmers, another one for the small farmers. Small farmer needs help in the beginning, but they also need good seed. And having factor, issue of biodiversity, a lot of other things, but still they need good technology. Find an alternative source for biofuels and create an international grain reserve under the United Nations, and we all get involved in this undertaking. That's what Dr. Borlaug would tell you. That would be the new mission statement from Dr. Borlaug. Thank you very much.
GMOs in the international community and the solution.
I'm glad you asked me. I avoided discussing GMO, but I'm a great believer that the GMO technology, once very well defined, taken care of, will help the family, small family farms, as it's helping the corporations. Simply because if you factor the climate change issues, the high temperature, the freezing temperatures, the drought and heat and so, water logging, I do not believe that the conventional genetics for major crops, at least major grain crops, we can make advances without those technologies. So, but it has to be taken care very care, has to be handled very carefully. It's a very controversial issue. Many governments, especially in case of wheat, it is still untouchable. Even though we know that the maize and soybeans and cotton been basically used, the latest statistic is the GMO are on more than 160 million hectares, predominantly limited to few countries only, and the few crops. But it will save farmers a lot of cost. Contrary to what people believe, it also will save the environment in terms of insecticide use, which are many poison in many areas. But we also have to look at the related consequences. It doesn't destroy the ecology and other beneficial biotypes. We need another green revolution. I don't know how we're going to feed the 7 to 9 billion people by 2050 without this continuing green revolution. Perhaps it may not be quantum jumps we're talking about, but there are possibility of continuously increasing the yield and the quality of our crops, to increase the nutritional values of our crops. It's a very complicated now, much more complicated than was done at the Green Revolution time, I mean the beginning of the 60s and 70s. Because you got to factor the nutrition in our grains, you got to factor the biodiversity, you got to factor the ecological damage, you got to save our rivers and mountains, and we can deforest, we can bring more. So we really can increase by increasing the yields per unit area. And I think some of the technology, the hybrid technology in wheat, hybrid and other crops, which is not there yet, and the GMO, perhaps would be the next frontier of science in looking some of these avenues. As a matter of fact, McFadden is perhaps my grandfather. Perhaps many of you don't know. McFadden's hope. He bred a variety in '30s. He crossed the Durham first, perhaps anybody first. He lived in South Dakota. He crossed the Durham wheat, which is called Emmer. I think the name of the variety was Yaroslav Emmer, to some Marquis, which was a popular variety at that time. As I discussed why Dr. Bolak was always interested in stem rust, because it was sweeping all the way from south to north, all the way in the highlands of Mexico, Stem Harbor. Stem Rust was harboring and going everywhere. Everybody was working. All the wheat breeders, pathologists, in one way or other, they were engaged in Stem Rust. McFadden, he made one cross only. Only one cross. He must have been communicating with God, because you never get make one cross and you get a good variety. And he produced a variety Hope. Hope had the combination of genes, which he didn't know yet. His name today, SR2 complex. That the gene became the backbone of Dr. Borlaug's wheat breeding program. So and Norman believed in that one. He knew about that. McFadden perhaps never saw the results, grand experiments done on his Hope, his variety Hope. But that's the basis of today we protect the Stem Rust around the world. A few examples here and there where we don't, but around the world, that complex is not one gene. He just brought the whole complex together in that combination. And that, we must recognize McFadden. There was some conference this year in South Dakota, but I think something you've got to do for that. As you see, that's the average 1% per year. It doesn't happen. The yield potential gains doesn't happen each year. It once in a while, you wait for 10 years, 15 years, and then maybe you make one jump for 20 years, 20%. Then you can calculate by the number of years, and that's what they report. Okay, but it doesn't happen that way. Genetics doesn't operate that way. And it's a lot of efforts has to go in that one to do that. Remember that in our what we call continuing or protecting the benefit and increasing over the Green Revolution variety. But it has taken almost up to, we didn't realize after Dr. Borlaug's first variety, which went across the world, we worked for 15 years and in one combination, we increased the yield by 30%. And it was done maintaining all the good ingredients which Norman had in his variety. But we had to use a variety from Russia, which was given to me from Warren Cronstadt, and so, okay. We didn't expect something to happen. You know, the combining ability, you guys know a lot, okay. It's just unpredictable, but happens. If we make a lot of crosses, you will... Good population. Look at, as Borlaug said, you sweat with those plants. Look at where they are. You will find them, and that's where it happens.
According to his question about the second Green Revolution, do you think that we are in the right way to do it in terms of there's a conflict between the scientists who adopted the biotechnology
way and the ecological concept? So they are supporting a lot of money and a lot of efforts to finish it. Obviously, Ahmed, appears that there is a war going on between the high science, which I call the biotech part, and the modern breeding, let's say modern genomics based breeding, including transgenics, one side, and what would be classified as the organic farming. Okay. I do believe that there is a place for both. There will be circumstances where we'll be doing combination, and when you talk about the conservation agriculture, it's basically conservation agriculture uses the part organic farming, also uses the other elements, micronutrients, but also needs high genetics. So I don't see there's a conflict, but it looks like that the world is getting polarized. Looks like we some going there, some going there. But the factor one thing, whatever we do in the today and the future, we have to protect. We don't have enough lands. We don't have any more lands. Yeah, you know, in Egypt, you can't bring any more lands. And we got to protect the biodiversity, what we have. That means simply means that we can't just expand the area. And so we have to have increased yield. At the same time, we got to factor nutritional value of that grains. And that's where the CGIAR programs and the enriching the micronutrients become very vital. They've done a good job, I think.
Dr. Rajaram will be here for a few minutes following, and he's open for some informal questions, but let's give him a hand.